I was so obsessed with this idea. And so, you know, I shaved my head. I told my boss I'm quitting. And a couple months later,
why did you shave your head?
I was always just kind of curious, to be honest, what I would look like with a shaved head. But it just, it felt very suitably dramatic, you know, like new hair, new me.
Welcome to Conversations with Lulu. My name is Lulu Khazan. I'm an entrepreneur living in Dubai, an investor, a mother, and your host. I'm joined by my friend Khaled Qtaili, the founder and CEO of Legacy, a startup that provides from-home fertility services for men with the aim to change the outdated view that fertility is a woman's issue. A quick disclaimer, I'm a super proud investor in Legacy and fully believe in their mission to become the fatherhood company, helping over 100 million men on the journey to becoming a father. I knew this conversation was going to be fun. The more I learned about Khaled, the more similarities I found between us. We both left home at 17. We both left our jobs and started a business from scratch as first-time entrepreneurs at age 29. We both won startup competitions. We believe in creating momentum to make things happen, and we simply can't fail because people are relying on us. Khaled has had an eventful childhood spanning multiple countries. In fact, if you check out Khaled's social media profile, you'll see the flags of three countries.
I am 100% Palestinian, 100% Lebanese, and 100% Canadian.
How so?
Very bad at math. I mean, the more honest answer to that is, so my family is fully Palestinian by origin. They all left in 1948. They all moved to Lebanon. So I'm a Lebanese citizen, grew up in Lebanon, and then moved to Canada when I was 17.
What is Palestine to you? Because for me, obviously, I read the news. There's so many narratives out there. Yeah. But for you, as a Palestinian who hasn't really lived there, like, what does it mean to you?
If there wasn't an occupation, I think my sense of Palestinian identity would not be so important to me. Right. At the end of the day, I grew up in Lebanon. Most of my friends are Lebanese. It's where I go home, you know, for holidays or Christmas or summer. But I think that it's particularly important for us to retain a sense of identity because that sense of identity is being erased, right? So when you talk about things like falafel or hummus, right, and you hear them being co-opted by other parties, it becomes that much more important that you retain a sense of identity and also one that the world can respect. You know, it particularly is important to me if I'm successful to maintain my identity as a Palestinian, to be able to say, look, we're doing big things too. It's something that you should be learning more about. And so what I've always said is, if there wasn't an occupation, I probably would just identify as Lebanese.
I feel the same as a Lebanese sometimes. When I look at the Lebanese diaspora and all the achievements that we're doing around the world, and then you look at the state of Lebanon at the moment, the leaders that we have. So I really hear you. So what do you do to sort of keep the identity alive, let's say?
I think there's a few things that anyone who's proud of the culture they're from should stay close to. And you know, I'm not a big believer in nationalism. I'm not a big believer that the country you're from is better just because you were born there, right? But I think that every culture has bits and pieces that are valuable and that you should cherish. And so for me, a lot of it comes down to spending time with my grandparents. You know, this is how you stay close to your roots.
So your family left Lebanon then?
My mom's side of the family is from Yafa, and they left in 1948. They moved to Lebanon, and they had, so my grandfather had a business in Yafa that was, you know, completely taken away, moved to Lebanon, and he rebuilt. And what's so interesting is they spent a long time living in Lebanon. They then moved to Montreal for some time. And then they decided that as they were getting older, they wanted to move back to Lebanon to be closer to family, you know, closer to culture and closer to home. And then finally, the situation in Lebanon was so bad, they decided to move back to Montreal. And what's so painfully funny about this was that they packed up everything they had as part of their move back to Montreal, and they were preparing to have it shipped to Montreal from Beirut?
Oh.
And of course, where do you take furniture and personal belongings when they are going to be shipped? They were at the port. They arrived at the port on Monday afternoon, and then Tuesday, as we know, the port was no longer. And so it felt like both times in both countries, they were very, they had a very violent goodbye.
Can you even imagine dealing with such loss of property well in your 80s? Images of the Beirut explosion on that Tuesday, the 4th of August, are still fresh in my mind. And I know a thing or two about picking up the pieces and rebuilding. Unfortunately, I've had to see my parents and countless families do it. My wish is for the suffering to end so that the future generations of Lebanon can just live peacefully. As I've mentioned on the show before, and even on Nadine's episode a couple of weeks ago, despite the feeling of helplessness at times, I feel so strongly connected to the country. And I was curious to find out what growing up in Lebanon was like for Khaled.
I think everyone goes through hard times, especially when you're a awkward-looking teenager, like I most definitely was. I honestly didn't even know. So my family's mixed religion, and I legitimately did not know which sect of Islam my mom's side of the family was from. And at some point, I asked her. You know, I was 13 or 14. I'm like, "Mama, are we Sunni or Shia?" You know, it was. And then she told me, and I kept forgetting because it was just so much not a. It was not a part of our upbringing. We celebrated Eid, we celebrated Christmas, we did Easter, you know, anything that was an excuse for gifts and presents, I was and still am in full support of.
It's so amazing that you say that. You know, I had the other, like, the different experience. So I grew up in Brumana, and Brumana is a Christian town. Don't think I met a Muslim up until I was, like, maybe 16 or 17. And it's unbelievable because, you know, As a young person, I didn't have a car, so I didn't used to drive to Beirut a lot, and we didn't grow up feeling very, you know, exposed, let's say, to different religions and different cultures. But also the other time is when I arrived to Dubai in 2003, and shortly after there was Ramadan, and people were celebrating Ramadan, and I was like, "What is Ramadan?" Like, what, you know, and. It's amazing, but I'm glad that you grew up basically not feeling this religious tension that we feel. That's important.
I grew up Chrislam.
Chrislam. So your dad was a Christian.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So you grew up in Lebanon, and then at 17 you went to Canada.
I think violent expulsion is a theme in my family because this was 2006, I was in 12th grade, I guess, when the Hariri assassination happened, and at the time I was deciding between AUB and McGill. I was going for the most mundane thing on the planet. I was going for a swim. You know, I'm getting ready to leave the apartment, and I call out to my brother. I'm like, "Hey, bro, I'm going for a swim." And he calls me, he's like, "Khaled Talon, come here." And the TV's on, and our airport was just on fire. Like, it just was in flames, right? And we kind of just sat there, and we thought, "Oh, shit, what now?" And our parents were abroad, so we were 17 and 19. We were at home and basically had to figure out what to do. We ended up escaping through Syria, which was the safe country at the time, and ended up making it over to Montreal, with just some extremely long travel. And that was the point at which my decision had basically been made for me.
It may be 2020, but unfortunately, Lebanon still suffers from bombings that terrorize, traumatize, and force people to leave. Yet many of us, myself included, still fantasize about the day we go back.
I would love to go back with the right time, the right opportunity. I've always thought about where I would want to raise a family. And, you know, I've brought it down to probably a couple of cities in the world. Beirut would be on that list. It's just... Beirut makes it so difficult to go back, right? It's like an abusive relationship. And so in principle, I would love to. In reality, I can't imagine it happening anytime soon.
So how was Canada for you? How was the experience at McGill?
Canada was transformational for me. I have a very soft spot in my heart for Montreal because this is kind of where I always felt like this is where I became who I am today, or kind of began to. I came from a very small high school in Beirut. My graduating class was, I think, 67 students, right? So it was one of those schools where everyone knew everything about everyone, right? And everyone had been in the same grade since fourth grade, and their older brothers and sisters had studied there, right? Until today, you tell me someone's name and I know their last name, I know their brothers and sisters, you know, I know if they were good at school or not. And McGill had, I think, something like 10,000 students.
Oh, wow.
And so I have this very distinct memory of walking down McGill campus one day, and I just had this glorious, amazing feeling. And I thought to myself, no one has any idea who I am. And it was one of the most liberating feelings, because for the first time in a long time, I felt like I could define my own identity and who I wanted to be. And I was still 17, and I was a very young 17-year-old.
Khaled, did your parents like push you on the education front? Because, I mean, when you and I had a chat, you told me that your parents were extremely educated.
This is, I think it's a very classic Palestinian story. We all grew up hearing the same thing, right? Which is, education is the one thing that no one can ever take away from you. And so being educated means that you've built a life for yourself, and a life that is transferable if you need to, right? Which is kind of a sad thing when you hear about it, but it's very true. And so my grandfather, he studied at Princeton and Swarthmore. He raised four daughters, all of whom got at least a master's, two of them got PhDs. My dad's side of the family as well, big focus on education. And so this really was a big part of the upbringing of my brother and I. It was just understood and expected that we were going to push ourselves to be kind of the best version of ourselves, to be prepared for whatever happens. And part of that meant, you know, you had to study hard and go to a good school and get a good job.
And when you posted a photo of your mom a couple of years ago with her graduation hat and, you know, your mom graduating from Harvard after you have graduated from Harvard. I mean, wow.
It was a reverse legacy. I was the one who nominated. I wrote her a letter of recommendation.
Wow.
it was a great feeling, and it was funny because it just felt like the roles were reversed. You know, I was telling her like, "Mama, I'm so proud of you." You know, usually it's the other way around, and she had her cap and gown on. So she went to the Kennedy School like I had. She did their 1 year mid career master's program. She jokes that because she was one of the older students, she was in the late mid career stage in her life. But it was very cool.
Yeah,
and the only thing is I told her, you're not allowed to apply until after I've graduated. only then are you allowed to be on campus. But she took my apartment. She took my apartment. She took my furniture. She moved in.
Oh my God.
After I left.
Wow. Yeah. So that's phenomenal, actually. What did you do when you graduated? Did you, you went into consulting?
Yeah. So I graduated, so I wasn't violently expelled out of McGill, thankfully.
Actually, before we talk about consulting, did you go to Harvard right after McGill, or you did that later?
It was a few years later.
With his graduation coinciding with the 2008 global financial crisis, Khaled extended his stay at McGill and focused on learning French while trying to secure a job at top-tier consulting firms. He was lucky to end up at Oliver Wyman, but the working conditions were a lot tougher than he had expected, and his bosses were not very happy with his performance. Working in consulting meant that he needed to be an A-plus player all the time, and initially he wasn't ready for this kind of workload. Ultimately, he was at the risk of losing his job.
I'm extremely glad that I started my career in consulting, and something my dad had said to me at the time was, you know, you can go from consulting and then do anything you want after, but it doesn't work the other way around. And consulting is a very reputation-driven industry. So it's kind of a vicious cycle, right? So if you do badly on one project, your manager on that project kind of warns the manager on your next project saying, listen, you know, he's not great at attention to detail, for example. And that's a death sentence. That is the death sentence in consulting. Attention to detail and accuracy. These were my two, they called them development objectives.
Okay.
And there is no worse evaluation to get.
That's surprising though, because you come across like the type who really puts his mind to something and does it. So I'm surprised you let it like deteriorate that much. Yeah. You must have really like hated it for you not to put the effort, right?
Honestly, it messes with your head. It messes with your ego. It messes with your self-confidence. Because suddenly you're being told that you're shit at something, right? Like objectively, like you are just bad at this. And so, it was tough because it was such a vicious cycle. I basically said to myself, right, I either need to give up or I need to double down. And that was the moment I said, fuck it, I'm all in. And so at that point I went all out.
So after 3 years in consulting, Khaled managed to do a complete turnaround from a shaky start to nearly losing his job, and then total focus on becoming a top performer. That meant countless nights at the office, weekends and holidays working, but eventually this experience was a pivotal one for his career. He joined the Harvard Kennedy School to do a master's in public policy and ultimately found himself working with the World Economic Forum. This is where I first met him as well.
It's a fascinating place because you are... Because it taught me an important lesson, which is just because you are close to power doesn't necessarily mean that you have it yourself. And in fact, it almost feels like sometimes the closer you are, the less power you have, because you're so there's such a clear hierarchy at those levels. So I met Justin Trudeau at a party in Davos. I actually broke into the party because I was wearing Canadian socks and his security team let me inside, even though I wasn't on the invite list. It was like Justin Trudeau, 25 heads of state, and Khaled Kteili with nice Canadian socks on. But I went up to him and we chit-chatted, and we have a great photo of both of us showing off our socks. But that experience reminded me that, or really showed to me that just because you have access to these people doesn't mean that they care what you think. Justin Trudeau, I'm fairly confident, does not remember that interaction or care about that interaction or care about any of my thoughts on world affairs.
I mean, you are in a place where a lot of decisions are being made and high level discussions. Yeah. So did you want to work there because you felt you wanted to put your thoughts out there?
I think I wanted to work there for a couple of reasons. One is I still didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I felt like I had checked the box in my previous career. I had spent a great 2 years kind of in the public policy world. But when I was making the decision to join the forum, and by the way, anyone at the World Economic Forum would have a heart attack if I said WEF, so I will say the forum.
Okay.
So I found consulting was like on the spectrums of how much good are you doing for the world, extremely low, but how efficiently and effectively are you doing it, extremely high. And then I had spent some time working with the UN. I spent about 6 months volunteering with them. And there, the good you're doing for the world is extremely high, but the efficiency and effectiveness with which you're doing it is extremely low. So I graduated from this public policy degree thinking, okay, well, I want to find something that is high on both. And that's what I thought the World Economic Forum might be. But so yes, you are very close with individuals who have power. And certainly I got close to ministers and CEOs, and that's quite meaningful because it showed me two things. One is that these people are not better than you. They're not smarter than you. They're not necessarily more talented than you. Sometimes they are, right? Sometimes they're taller than you. Justin Trudeau is actually surprisingly tall and extremely handsome, so that's hard to compete against, right? But it shows you these people are not special. A lot of times they came from families that were politically connected or financially well off. Yeah. They had a leg up in life a lot of the time. And for me, I loved seeing that because it just reminded me that I'm not missing anything to be able to do those kinds of things myself.
So this was one,
and this was just a very important realization. It felt very significant. But the second was I got tired of convening people. I wanted to be the convened. Mm-hmm. And this was a very big thing that just kind of kept coming back to me, which is how do you switch from convening powerful people to becoming one of those people?
So why did you feel it wasn't very effective?
It wasn't necessarily that it wasn't effective. It's that a lot of times people were coming to events like Davos with their own agendas, right? So they were coming less to watch the official program or sit in sessions. Those tended to be secondary to what they were actually there to do, which is they have meetings and there's circles of power within Davos, right? At the very outer end, you have people who are just visiting. It was almost like a joke. They were called the hotel badges. Like they had a badge to stay at the hotel, but not, you know, obviously there's a bit of elitism there. And then within that, you have the people who are attending who are young global leaders, for example, or, you know, and then within it, there's the ministers and the heads of state and so on. And And what Davos teaches you very quickly is that there is always a tighter, closer circle of power with a party that you're not invited to.
When I met you in 2017, you started to think about, you know, starting a business shortly after that. And I remember you mentioning it to me, and I was thinking, man, this guy is nuts. Like, you're going from a super formal setting to something completely different. And I'm like, he's definitely not going to do it. And then you did it. Did you just say one day you just resigned and thought, okay, I have this great idea. Like, can you take me through the process?
So I'll go back a few years to give a little bit of context to this. So back in 2014, I was on a consulting project in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We're driving down the highway and we make a coffee run. So I, of course, was the youngest person on the team. And so it was my responsibility to go and get everyone tea and coffee. So I'm getting these four coffees and teas, sitting in the passenger seat. I'm carrying these four cups of teas as we are driving to the client site.
Oh my God. And I can see where that's going.
We are on the highway. Oh, it's not going in a good place, I'll tell you.
I know. I'll tell you
that. So we're driving down the highway, and then someone in front of us brakes. And so, of course, we brake. Now, I remember very little, but all I know is the tea violently exploded out of... I only remember two things. I remember two things. The first thing I remember is just I have this moment where I see that I see everything leaning, the lids are coming off, and there's this very slow process in my brain, like, oh no, you know, like in the movies. The second thing I remember is just it fell all over my lap, all over my legs. And there was just this moment right before the pain hit. And let me tell you, having extremely hot tea spilling all over your lap is extremely painful. And so thankfully, I ended up getting only second degree burns, which heal up normally. But it was a period in my life where I had to go to the hospital. I couldn't wear jeans for a month. It was too painful. The skin was too raw.
So this got you thinking about, well, I'm not going to do the reveal. So I guess you tell us about Legacy, then the idea.
Sure.
I think we have an idea.
And that's why I started a business in tea. No, I'm kidding. So a couple months later, I was starting at the Kennedy School and I met a guy who was describing the process. So he was diagnosed with cancer when he was quite young. I think he was about 30. And he was describing the process and he was saying, you know, so I had to go through chemotherapy. Before I started chemotherapy, I had to freeze my sperm. And it was just kind of one of these really funny moments in life, you know, where I kind of like turned my head. I'm like, sperm freezing? What is that? Like, what? Why? He's like, you know, because chemotherapy is very harmful to your body. You may not be able to have kids in the future. And so my doctor recommended that I do it. So I had just had this, you know, extremely memorable, shall we say, experience, and I'm hearing this, and I think to myself, I'm like, huh, I had never heard of the concept before, right? And so I ask him, I'm like, okay, can anyone do it? He's like, yeah. I'm like, how much does it cost? He says, you know, it's about $1,000. I say, okay, I mean, it's not cheap, but it's not, you know, outrageous. It's not life-changing. It's not, you know, it's not outrageous. And so I did it myself. And I'm just
really?
Like, look, I just had an thankfully, I was blessed. I came out of that experience unscarred. But I just kept thinking, like, it could have been so much worse, right? And so I went and did it myself. I booked an appointment. It turns out the local sperm bank in Cambridge, Massachusetts, is right next door to my favorite Chinese restaurant. So super weird experience, even just going in. You're like smelling the dumplings. So you go in and the whole process was just so like antiquated and awkward. So, you know, you come
clinical.
In and they ask you extremely clinical. So they come in and they ask you like, okay, well, sir, are you here for a vasectomy? Are you here because you have cancer? Or are you here because you are transitioning to become a woman? And I said, look, honestly, I don't think any of the three.
It's not that serious.
I'm like proactive. And they gave me the weirdest look, you know, and they like probably wrote down weirdo, and you know, they hand you what they call the specimen cup, right? And they're like, sir, if you could go ahead and produce the specimen, we do have some materials available for your perusal. These of course like really weird, kinky, fucked up porn
magazines
that like you don't want to touch anything. There's like a leather couch in the room, you know, you're like, am I in a porno? Or like, you know, the room is tiny. Anyway, I had two thoughts coming out of that. So I said, number one, I am so glad that I did this because I know that for the rest of my life, I will be able to have kids. It is, to me, was the ultimate life insurance policy. It's like the ability to create life insurance policy. And so that honestly felt amazing. And then the second part of it was, God, I wish this experience wasn't so terrible. Like, I wish it wasn't so awkward. I wish it wasn't so clinical. What if you could do it from home? You know, so it just set me down this path of this is something that I think every guy would want to do or be interested in doing at some point, right? At the right price point, at the right convenience level, and so on. This was one of those moments where, you know, it just it was the beginnings of an idea. Like, believe me, I did not grow up thinking, you know, I was going to be in the male fertility space, right? This was not my childhood dream. I wanted to be a soccer player. Although I tell people we're still playing with balls, so I guess it's fine.
this little kernel of idea stayed with you throughout university, right?
For years. All my friends heard about it. They called me the sperm king. I actually almost started the company right after HKS, after my master's, with a Lebanese guy who unfortunately was not as excited about the idea as I was. And so that kind of fell apart.
And then what pushed you to do it then? Yeah. At what point did you say, that's it, I'm doing this? Yeah.
So I'd been thinking about the idea. I'd been working on the idea. I had been getting everything ready. And so there came this moment in February 2018 where I'm not even kidding when I say I woke up one day. It was like I dreamt it. It was like a sign from the Lord, whichever Lord you want. And it was just, it's time. And I basically, that week, I sat down with my boss and I told him, listen, he was a wonderful boss, but I don't think he completely understood at the time because I was coming to him totally out of left field, right? And be like, well, I've had a wonderful experience working with you. You're amazing. The team is wonderful. I'm quitting my job to start a sperm business. and there was this moment, and it was tough actually because I was doing really well in my job. I was on the verge of getting promoted. You know, I was moving at a very accelerated pace, but I was so obsessed with this idea. And so, you know, I shaved my head. I told my boss I'm quitting, and a couple months later,
why did you shave your head?
I was always just kind of curious, to be honest, what I would look like with a shaved head. But it felt very suitably dramatic, you know? Like new hair, new me.
So you unviolently expelled yourself out of the out of the web?
Correct. It was a very peaceful expulsion. And so a few months later, I left my job. I left the city. I packed everything up. And I flew to Boston. And so I just figured, you know, if I'm starting this journey where I know I had no entrepreneurial friends. I had one friend who was an entrepreneur. That was it. So I had no idea what I was in for. I obviously had done everything that every entrepreneur, like future entrepreneur, does, right? I had read Paul Graham. I had, you know, applied to Y Combinator. I had done all this stuff. But it just, I realized I need to just suck it up and do it. And I did it all in one go. I even left my cat behind. Sashimi, rest in peace. She was a wonderful cat. I had to go back and get her seven months later. Because I was coming to the US as a business tourist at that time. I can't come to the US and be like, yes, hello, I'm here for business with my cat. Sashimi. So she's my emotional support animal. Anyway, it was a big move. I landed in Boston and I said, this is it. It's time.
So you had to completely rewire yourself pretty much from the consulting guy to the World Economic Forum, highly political, bureaucratic enterprise, to become super lean and entrepreneurial and launch Legacy, your sperm startup.
So what I did a couple of things. The first and most important was I didn't tell anyone that I was moving back. So I did this totally in hideout. I was, funnily enough, by the way, I moved back in with my mom. So she was graduating. And so I moved back into my own apartment, which was my furniture that my mom was now taking over. And so I went back to living with my mom for a few months. And I just, what I learned, or the risks that I had seen at that point, was the biggest risk is losing focus. The biggest risk is getting distracted. I think, to be honest, part of it was I had been telling so many people for so long that I was going to do this, right? It kind of felt like, okay, I can't.
You're going to look like an idiot.
I can't afford to fuck it up now. Yeah.
I know the feeling.
And so.
But that's the best way to do things.
Get out. It is. I was super focused on it. And it was actually one of the best periods of my life, where I just had to be, I was super fit. I was biking. I was eating well because my mom was cooking. For 3 months, it was pure focus. And so when I applied, so Harvard has a program called the Launch Lab X, which was for alumni-led ventures. And it was the first time they were starting it. And I applied. And when they interviewed me, you know, they asked me, like, are you moving from Geneva? Or like, what? I don't get it. Like, what are you doing? Like, who are you? Like, what is this bizarre business that you're starting? And I told them, look, I'm here. I'm in Central Square, and I'm doing this whether you take me or not. And they later told me, they're like, these were the words of someone who was so dedicated to what he was going to do that we couldn't not take you.
This is definitely something, you know, I see in you also. Like, you're quite serious, I think, when you say something, and you're very dedicated. So a lot of people usually struggle with discipline, right? Like, you're passionate about something, and you go and you try to do something, and then it falls apart because obviously you don't have the discipline. Yeah. So you had to rewire yourself completely. So do you have any tips in terms of, you know, what can someone do if they're struggling to be disciplined?
Yeah, this is just a hypothesis, but I think there's two things that matter a lot, which is you need to set very high standards for yourself, which is, and this is actually something that consulting ingrained in me, but you cannot accept less than excellence from yourself, because nobody else is going to hold you to those standards. It has to be from you. And this is actually extremely important when you end up, if you are running a business, because who you are and the way you behave gets absorbed into the culture of your company and the people around you. So this is one, which is you need to set those standards for yourself. And you need to surround yourself with people who have those kinds of standards for themselves as well. Because you end up being so influenced by the people who are around you. This is one. And the second is you need to be passionate about what you're doing. You really do. Because I work my ass off for legacy. Of course I do, right? I eat, breathe, sleep, dream, the company and the business and so on. But the act of building a company is something I'm so passionate about and that I love so much. And it doesn't feel like work in the same way. And so putting in extreme hours or being very disciplined doesn't feel difficult in the way that it would if it was something that I hated doing.
I thought about my own discipline. How do I do the stuff I do? I don't necessarily have a ritual, and yet I always manage to find a way to get things done. The secret sauce for me is gathering momentum by sharing my goals with a few friends or colleagues, and that momentum helps propel me in the right direction. Along the way, if I'm convinced that my goal is worthy, then motivation comes naturally. Shifting back to legacy, did you know that 1 in 7 couples face infertility? And men are equally likely as women to be the cause.
So there are a few really interesting trends just as a species. So the UK last year announced their lowest birth rate in recorded history. Like, in their recorded history, they have never had a lower birth rate. So part of this is just socioeconomic. It's just people choosing not to have kids or delaying kids. But part of it is also biological. So if you look at the demographics in the US, for example, the median age has gone up a lot.
In general.
The median age of the average, person in the US is now older. The median person is now older. Couples meet later. They get married later. They try to have children later. And so if you're talking about a heterosexual couple, then what this means is when they're trying to have kids now in their, you know, early to mid 30s, it's much more difficult than it would have been a few decades ago when everyone was younger. Then at the same time, as guys are older, the average age of a man trying to become a father is older. Sperm quality also declines with age, which is something that most men don't know. So every year you get older, your sperm quality goes down. The genetic mutations in your sperm go up. All of these basically lead to negative pregnancy outcomes. But what's so interesting is that over the last 40 years, male fertility, like sperm count and sperm concentration, has gone down by 50 to 60%. And
why
here's
doesn't anyone talk about this, by the way? Yeah. I'm surprised.
Listen, I talk about this all the time. Believe me, a few years, everyone will be talking about this. Everyone in my life knows all the statistics about sperm. But here's what I think is so interesting, because I used to make fun of people who were super organic, you know, no chemicals in my house, you know, and I always thought it was over the top, and I've become one of those people. So nothing is conclusive or definitive, but it seems extremely likely that this is happening because of the chemicals that are around us in our households, in our shampoos and conditioners and everything else, BPAs and phosphates and the chemicals and plastic. So someone did a study. I don't know whose life specialty this is. You think my specialty is weird? Someone's specialty is the sperm of dogs. Okay, this is their work, and they did a very fascinating study, and they found that dogs that live in human households faced a similar decline in sperm quality as humans did, but dogs that lived outside of human households did not. So literally, I do organic everything, I do chemical free whenever I can, I changed my shampoos and soaps and everything.
So what's your advice for men to have healthy sperm?
Obviously, freeze your sperm now while you're young and you're healthy and while you still can.
When is a good time to freeze your sperm?
If you're over the age of 20, do it. If you're over the age of 35, definitely do it. If you're over the age of 50, let's talk.
So how can Legacy help? Yeah. Can anyone get the kit, or is it only available in the US at the moment? Yeah.
We are actively talking to the UAE Ministry of Health. So if any of your listeners have any wasta or connections, please do share. But we're in active conversations to expand to the UAE. It's part of a broader international expansion strategy that we have.
Do you have numbers on our part of the world versus the US in terms of the fertility?
Yeah. Yes. So actually the Middle East, there's a professor at Yale, Professor Marsha Inhorn, who's phenomenal. And she actually did a study and found that the rate of male infertility in the Middle East is higher than anywhere else in the world.
Why? Is there what's the reason?
So there's a few theories, one of which is just that's definitely part of it. Obesity, ergile, there's been more wars in the region.
Yes, of course.
But something, by the way, just as an aside, for women who are thinking about getting pregnant, by far the most impactful thing you can do is stop smoking. There's no comparison. That's basically the one recommendation that every woman gets, just as an aside. So the really interesting theory, so apart from obesity and ergile and lack of exercise and all this, is it's called co-sanguinity, which is when you have cousins that get married, and over one generation, two cousins marrying is actually not genetically, it's not particularly harmful. But when you have families that have been doing it for generations, right? And we all know families like this. By the third, fourth, fifth generation, you see much higher likelihood of negative genetic mutations that occur. And these can lead to infertility. And so it actually tends to be those families that have the biggest challenges.
How has it been as an experience for you as an entrepreneur? Is there something that's unique that you do when you're hiring people? You spoke about culture earlier as well, so... What's special there?
It's funny to me, in the US, they talk a lot about diversity, and it always feels like they talk about it in a very forced way. You're like, oh, well, you have to have an African-American on your team. Oh, you have to have someone who's Latinx on your team. You have to have a woman on your team. And this, to me, feels like the worst kind of forced diversity. And they've even had studies showing that you know, it even affects the self-confidence of someone who's asking themselves, right, was I hired due to affirmative action, or was I hired because I genuinely am the best at what I do? And it's interesting, being for having lived and worked in so many different countries, diversity has just been a very natural part of my life. And so my team, by extension, is naturally very diverse in terms of backgrounds, cultures, religions, socioeconomic status, political views. And I think this is, it's just, I'm so happy that it became a part of our culture. And I never have to worry that we're going to be a bunch of white tech bros. Okay. But the biggest thing that I've done when it comes to team is, you have to invest in the people who are around you, and you have to give them all the tools that they have to become the best version of themselves. And honestly, I think that I'm very impacted by my time in consulting, where I felt like I was I felt like I was capable, but still struggling. And I felt like I didn't have the tools to succeed. And so today I care so much about making sure that everyone on my team has everything they need to succeed. And so everyone gets an executive coach. I've had one for years. And it is honestly, it's foundational to the company. It's like a therapist. It's a professional therapist, right? Every weekly meeting we have, it's like a part of our culture. It started almost as a joke, but it's now like, okay, here's what I'm doing this week. Here are my blockers. Here's how I slept last night. And here's how I feel. You know, today I feel a little bit grumpy because I didn't sleep well and I'm fighting with my, you know, whatever. I'm fighting with my parents. And so sorry, I'm in a bad mood. And so it just has built this I think emotional awareness into the company.
So you kind of build empathy also, right? Like you try to put yourself in their shoes and see what they're facing. Yeah. And
we're a very positive team. And actually, one thing we have that I'm sure is unique to Legacy, we call it the Legacy Clap. And this was inspired by my aunt Sophie. Shout out. My dad said to the family, the way they clap is not like a normal, you know, like, hey, bravo, very good. It's like it's loud, it's obnoxious, you know, like it's like open fingered, like, bravo, very good. and so we have internalized this into the company. And so when someone does something worth celebrating, which is often, we give them the Legacy Clap. And everyone has come up with their own cultural variations, right? So mine is very like Arab style, but everyone has modified it.
So you care a lot about taking care of your team to make sure they have everything they need to succeed. And what about you? Was there something that has changed in you as well, being an entrepreneur?
Yeah. I discovered a very new concept, which is the concept of anxiety. I am by nature an extremely not anxious person. Never have been my whole life. I sleep well. I'm a happy person. I have love in my life. You know, I love my family. But this was a new experience to me where I would suddenly have trouble falling asleep at night, you know, because you're thinking about all the things that are going on. Yeah. You're thinking about how to optimize everything you're doing. And this is a very new thing to me where sometimes I have trouble sleeping because I'm thinking so much about the business. So this was a very negative, unhappy learning, but a reality. And one of my friends, actually that same one friend, Karn, who is an entrepreneur, from day one, he told me, listen, man, enjoy it while you can, because it only ever gets worse.
You know what? I could never plan things. You know, my husband would be okay. I have like 30 days. Like I want to take 20 days, you know, on August 15 up until, you know, September 10. I'm like, I can't do that. No. It's you tell yourself that, like, no, I have it under control, you know, and then you need your partner to remind you that, Lulu, you say this all the time.
What's really crazy is when you wake up one day and you realize it's been about 2.5 years that I've been doing this full time. And it's just, it's crazy how quickly the time passes. It really is.
Yeah. And you've raised, you know, a decent amount of money so far. You have people's career growth. You have their livelihoods, their benefits. It's like a machine,
I mean, what you're describing is something that I think a lot about, which is just the concept of inertia. You know, an object at rest stays at rest and an object in motion stays in motion. And when I think about the first few months of Legacy, it was, I was trying to get myself to the point of inertia. I was trying to get myself to the point where I had put enough kinetic energy into the business that it would just keep going. And what's really special about that is that now, even if I drop off the face of the earth for a month, which I wouldn't, the business will keep going, right? Everyone knows their roles. There is money coming into the company, you know, and even for me, I know that I could never leave what I'm doing because I have people who rely on me. I have salaries that I need to help pay. Yeah. I have people's careers and livelihoods that I need to think about. And so the beautiful thing is now there is so much inertia in the company that it just feels like it's rolling and rolling and growing and growing.
Yeah, well, I'm going to let you tell this to yourself because I don't think it's the case. You have to be there all the time and you have to drive it, man. Yeah. I think this is wishful thinking.
Look, it wouldn't collapse if I left.
No, it won't collapse. No, it won't collapse. It won't collapse, but it's not as simple. I wanted to ask you, how do you feel about being like a solo founder? Because that's tough also. And you're a first-time entrepreneur as well. So you're going through a huge learning curve at the same time.
Yeah. So my advice to anyone thinking about starting a company by yourself is it sucks. Don't do it. And, you know, I think I had to by necessity because, believe it or not, people are not super excited about starting a sperm freezing business. And, you know, I had a few kind of false starts with trying to launch the company with other people. And it just didn't work out because they were not as crazy passionate about the idea as I was. And so when I first started, I ended up having to do it by myself. And it just, what it really does is it increases the risk level. It increases the difficulty because for the first year, at least, I was working basically two shifts. I would wake up and I'd work from 11 to 5 or 6. I'd do like a full workday. And then I take a couple of hours off and then I'd get back to work at 9 and I would work until about 2 or 3 in the morning. And part of it is I'm a night owl, so that's when I'm most productive, but it's just the bar that gets set is so much higher. And you have to do that much more research to figure out what are the things that I might not be thinking about as a first-time founder.
So I want to wrap up with a couple of questions to which I'd like very short answers. If you were to give a commencement speech to university students, what would you say?
I'd say, do whatever the fuck you want.
Who makes the best hummus?
The Lebanese. Come on. What kind of question is this?
I don't know. There's a lot of people are claiming
They're wrong.
Ownership over hummus. Okay. What are you most excited about?
Series A. We're so close. I can taste it. That's what I'm so excited about.
That's fantastic news. And how do you feel after this this conversation?
I feel excellent. I feel guilty because I realize that I'm 6 minutes late to my own team meeting, which
was
against
share
one of
your
our
feelings?
Team norm. We'll talk a lot about our feelings, but I feel great. And it was nice to talk about something that wasn't work because it ends up inevitably being such a big part of your life.
Thank you so much, Khaled.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for tuning into this episode. I hope you felt inspired. There's a link in the show notes to Legacy if you'd like to check them out or offer up some of your wasta to get them to launch in the UAE. Special thanks to Noura Sadaka, who worked with our team as a creative consultant for this episode's content and an embodiment coach. I'd love to get your feedback. You can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or IMDb and reach out to me on Instagram at Lulu Khazan. For collaborations, partnerships, or guest recommendations, drop me an email at lulu.khazan@gmail.com. See you in 2 weeks.